Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Somerset County Tourism. Hear stories from local brewers and distillers from the New Jersey Sip and See Trail on episode 647 of Beer Sessions Radio, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Karen McNeil. We'll talk to Karen about the newly updated third edition of the Wine Bible, Wine Speed, and a lot more. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Karen McNeil is an award-winning wine speaker, consultant, journalist, educator, and author, among other things. When I say award-winning, I'm talking about an Emmy and a James Beard Award, among others. She has her own line of stemware and publishes her weekly newsletter and website, WineSpeed. Karen just released the fully revised and updated third edition of the Wine Bible yesterday. The Wine Bible has sold a million copies and is one of the best all-time selling wine books. Welcome back to The Grape Nation, Karen.
Hi, Sam.
I want to remind you that you were last on The Grape Nation in February of 2017, which was a while ago. And I mean, you and I have been around wine a lot. We've drank a lot. You know, we've done a lot. But that was only my 17th episode of the podcast. So I was a neophyte. Now I'm an old experienced. All right, so we're talking to Karen remotely via our app Zencastr. So Karen, where are you right now?
I am in my office right in the heart of the Napa Valley in the little town of St. Helena.
Okay, that's a very cool town. Now, how long have you been out there?
Let's see. I moved from New York to Napa Valley in 1994.
So it's been a while. And I kind of know the answer, and you've talked about it, but why did you then make your way there?
Yeah, you know, it was, of course, my friends were shocked. They were like, wait a minute, where are you going? But I believed that somehow being closer to grapevines would make me a better writer. It was kind of, it seemed very unreal to me that there you are sitting in Manhattan, all dressed up, you're not anywhere near a grapevine, but you're taking notes and kind of passing judgment on wines. And it almost seemed, I suppose, a little unfair to me. And I decided that to really know wine better, I needed to be really in it more. I needed to, through osmosis, be around farmers and winemakers and viticulturalists and pick up through osmosis some of the things they knew. So
it's funny you say that, because I was going to use the word osmosis. But yeah. Was California the obvious choice, or you pondered over a few things?
No, you know, I knew once I decided that I wanted to be in wine country, I knew it was going to be Napa Valley. There are so many other parts of wine in the United States in regions that I love. I adore the Willamette Valley in Oregon. I think the Walla Walla region of Washington State is just on fire with such excitement and lots of young new producers. But for me, you know, the pull of Napa, which is small and so beautiful, was very strong.
So it's funny you say that, because I think Napa is what really drew me into wine, you know, in a deep way. With my wife, you know, way back in the 90s, we became drinkers, collectors. We paid attention to everything. Do you still feel the same way about what's going on in Napa, Sonoma, that you did, you know, the 15, 20, 25 years ago since you've been there?
Yes, I do. Because, you know, I think when you become as famous as Napa Valley, you also become the object of lots of criticism. So, you know, so many journalists just love to, I don't know, bash Napa Valley as the most capitalistic wine region. Prices are so high. Big corporate wineries are here. And I think people get that story wrong. And I think it's unfair to denigrate.
What's the wrong part?
Napa is not, 95% of all of the wineries here are family owned and produce fewer than 5,000 cases of wine. So it is not some, you know, center of enormous corporate influence.
Right.
Of course, there are a couple of big wineries, Behringer, Mondavi, but 95% of the 500 wineries here packed into one little 30-mile long valley, you can imagine, they're small.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
And they have, and in Sonoma, it's absolutely true. Most of the wineries are small and family-owned.
Even more than Napa, so, right?
Well, yes, because Sonoma is much larger than Napa.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I think the values that made those two regions what they are today are still there. And I love these two regions.
I think that's well said, and I think that's a reason for people to pay attention to the region and, you know, look deeper, you know, look beyond, you know, those big wineries, because you're right. I mean, there's a lot of exciting stuff there. All right, so before we get into the wine Bible, because that's why I chased you down, tell me... I'm always curious what people are doing. Tell me what you've been focusing most of your time on since you finished the book. I'm guessing that, you know, there was a big run up to the book, working, getting it done, deadlines and all that. That ends. It's almost like a wedding. You wake up the next day. What do I do now? I know you're going to go out and promote it, but tell me what you've been focusing your time and energy on.
You know, one thing is writing a book, researching and writing it. And this third edition of the Wine Bible took about 4 years to write. But then when you're done, most people think, okay, you're done. You've written the last word. But in point of fact, you have another couple of years where you have to kind of turn your baseball cap around or something and really work incredibly hard at going out, meeting people, getting them excited about wine, and of course, selling your book at the same time. So there's a lot of exciting promotional work that I'm doing now. And, you know, not every writer really likes to do that, because if you imagine writing itself is very solitary, and you know, you're just with yourself all through all of those thousands and thousands of hours.
Right.
But then when you start to promote the book, you're really out there with people. And so it's quite a different feeling. But also my business here in the Napa Valley, we do writing is only one part of it. We do a lot of private tastings for companies and for corporations and for major law firms and tech firms and right. medical firms and insurance firms. So we've always got lots of events going on.
Yeah. So that's great because you're always out there, you're with people, you're gauging what they're, you know, thinking and doing, and you're tasting wines. You know what kind of jumped at me when you were talking about, you know, once you wrote the book, what you have to do after? You're way more famous now releasing this book than when you did the first book. So that has to help, right?
Yeah, you know, I suppose it does. But when the first Wine Bible came out in 2001, you're right, I was not very well known. But no American had really ever written a big wine book before. All of the big wine books had been written by British authors. So I think, you know, the Wine Bible immediately got a lot of attention because it was very different than the way the big British wine books had been written.
So you've said this in the past. You didn't think you knew wine journalism was a male-dominated, you know, thing. And you certainly alluded to that. You know, you even drilled it down a little. It was a bunch of old British guys or whatever. So you're a woman in wine, and, you know, thank God women in wine are way more prominent and, you know, equally accepted, although there's still a ways to go. Do you still think wine journalism is male-dominated? And do you think the perceptions of wine consumers are based on that, you know, wine male domination writing?
The world is losing wine writers, whether they're men or women.
Okay.
It's increasingly hard, in fact, virtually impossible now to make a living solely by writing. There are now in the United States only two newspapers left that have a wine writer, a full-time wine writer on salary.
San Francisco and New York?
San Francisco and New York.
And Eric.
Yep. Esther Mobley and then Eric Asimov. So, you know, I don't worry very much anymore about if a writer is male or female. I just want there to be writers, because it's very important to a wine culture that communication about wine is spread. And if you didn't have writers, who would do that?
All right. So this segues into something that I'm very interested in hearing from you about. And that's social media and the internet. We'll get into that a little. I want to get a sense how both, you know, the internet and then social media came around, how they changed wine and how now you work as a digital wine writer. And to the point you made before that, there's two newspaper wine writers. But I think you and I can agree there's like trillions of wine bloggers, or, you know, however you describe them, whether it's a social media post or somebody has an extensive site. You know, so give me your views on social media and the internet, because we're going to talk about how you use them too. For the better, you know, tell me your thoughts.
Well, on the one hand, it's blogging and creating your own website has been fantastic because it's allowed so many more voices to be heard. And that is a categorically good thing. I guess, though, what worries me is two ideas. One is that a lot of young bloggers, it seems to me, immediately set themselves up as experts. And right. In my old-fashioned way, I guess I think, no, you know, it takes a long time to learn about wine. And And in a way, you have to earn your way there. You can't just instantaneously become an expert because you have a blog. On the other hand, a lot of blogs...
I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to hash that out a little. So, you know, anybody could go and do a blog. You know, you as a writer, you know, me as a podcast journalist, and then the consumer, just because somebody has a blog and they're writing about wine, does that implicitly make them an expert? I mean, is the consumer that silly where, you know, they're...
Well, no, the consumer shouldn't be. And to be fair to bloggers, a lot of bloggers, of course, don't suggest that they're experts. They okay. simply suggest that, you know, I'm a person who loves wine, and here are some of the things I've discovered, and I'd like to share them with you. And all of that is very, very valid and wonderful, as I was saying. I think the part that gives me pause sometimes, and in fact, the reason I created Wine Speed, is that, you know, any writer who does a lot of research knows that if you've got tough editors, and I feel like I have had some of the toughest editors in the world,
right.
those editors really put you through your paces. You have got to be able to prove to them how you know what you've written. And you are fact-checked in every possible way. And one of the things that the internet has done has given us lots of information, lots of opinions, lots of communication about wine, much of which never is fact-checked. So I feel like that's what I miss. Sometimes when I, you know, read a blog, I think, wait a minute, This just simply isn't true. If this person had done any bit of research, they would know that this is not true. And that makes me worried a little bit. So I guess in the end, I think social media and wine blogging is both wonderful and also a little dangerous.
I agree with that. And I agree that whether it's a retailer, a sommelier in a restaurant, a wine store, that you have to find the right source and trust them. And that's easier said than done. But when you do, you know, if you come to Karen McNeil's Wine Speed versus some guy who's just blathering, you know, you're going to be able to differentiate that. What you stated is what's been going on in the internet. I mean, politics, it's been documented the last 5 years. You know, how social media and the internet have been so distorted, you know, towards disseminating information. So you see the positives there, and there's definitely some negatives. Agree?
Definitely. And, you know, I'm thinking, just like writing, what has happened, to just take this one step further, is I think there is a kind of a group of bloggers who are really at the top of their game, who really do. They fact check themselves. They may not have an editor, but they've become well enough known, and they themselves have high enough standards that that their voices are expert, and what they bring to the world of wine is very valuable. I just wish that some of those voices had the opportunity to write also for magazines and newspapers. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, those two decades were just great decades for magazines all over the country on so many topics.
It was way more analog, but it was great.
Yeah, it was fabulous. And writers could be hired by those magazines. And, you know, that's largely gone away. So I don't know. I'm a little sad to miss those days.
I am sad too. There is a point where, you know, when the right people are out there doing the right thing, it's democratized a little, but then you lost that whole aspect of, you know, what you've been describing. And, you know, that is very sad. It's a changed world. Do you feel that you're comfortable, you felt you've done it right, you know, your pivot from, you know, really being back there as a wine writer to now somebody who's, you know, in a digital world? Because I'll say it for you. I mean, you're releasing one of the most wildly popular books and you have a very successful digital website. So you're doing both. I mean, was the pivot easy, reasonable for you?
Well, pivot implies to me that you've gone from one thing and you're now in a completely different direction.
So take pivot away, enhancing or adding or, you know, doing more.
No, I felt that in a way, I feel like Wine Speed and the Wine Bible are, they're just two sides of the same coin. One is, you know, a 700-page book. And the other is something that is so fast, comes to your email every Friday. You can read it in 3 minutes. It's really fun and fascinating. So I love both of these entities. And it's not that I'm giving up the Wine Bible to do more Wine Speed. I actually see them as being, I don't know, like siblings in a way.
But isn't it fair to say Wine Speed is a way for you to communicate with people on a regular basis?
Oh, definitely.
You're able to stay current, like you said, literally day to day, you know, shoot stuff out. So let's talk about Wine Speed. You know, give my peeps the elevator pitch. You know, Wine Speed is an important baby of yours. But, you know, tell people, you know, it's Karen McNeil, but here's what Karen's doing. This is my Wine Speed, and here's what I'm doing here.
Well, it's a digital newsletter. It's free, which is important. And every week on a Friday, you get an email from us. And it is, you know, it's very graphic and easy to read. And I began it in 2016 with the goal of kind of keeping wine at the top of people's mind just a little bit every week. And so we have about 40,000 subscribers.
Wow.
Every week we do a wine question and people, a quiz actually, and people love the quiz. They are.
Oh, can you recall a recent one? Just give me an idea of, you know, one of the questions.
Oh my goodness.
I knew you were going to.
What was a recent quiz? Oh, we might ask, what country is most of the Cabernet Sauvignon in the world grown?
Okay.
So it's often a, you know, a question that you think you know the answer to, but then you find that there's kind of a twist, like, oh, who
you
knew?
You would say California or Bordeaux. What's the answer?
Well, we would say California, Bordeaux, Chile, and maybe Australia, right? To make it a little bit harder.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you the answer, Sam. You have to subscribe to Wine Speed.
Well, I started looking at it when I knew I was going to be talking to you, but I didn't sign up for it. You know, I'm a lurker, but why wouldn't I go on it? I'm always the business guy. Why a free model? I mean, you have other ways to monetize it, or it helps you support everything else you're doing?
Well, you know, we've debated, to be honest, here in my office, whether or not we should charge for it. But I feel a kind of obligation to give back and to, you know, when you teach people, when you're a teacher, when you're an educator, everyone knows that teachers do not make a lot of money.
Right.
It's not because fair. Of your, yeah, it's your love of teaching. And so at least so far, this has been a way of giving back to the industry that I love. And it allows a lot of people to, you know, there's no barrier to getting Wine Speed. It's free, it's fun, it's fast. And and we like it that way.
Karen, I think that's awesome. Let's tell people, if I'm listening to this and I'm like, Jesus, why wouldn't I do that? Tell me exactly what I do. I go onto my computer. I go to winespeed.com.
Right. And a little box will pop up and it will say, would you like to subscribe?
Okay.
And you put your email in and you're done.
That's it.
Next Friday, you'll start getting it. Winespeed, one word.
That's great. Before we get into the book, I want to ask you a couple more things. I know, because I've seen them and noticed them, you've been doing some video tasting type stuff, you know, starting to do it on a regular basis. Tell me about that.
Yes.
Is it Tasting with Karen?
It's called Taste with Karen Live.
Taste with Karen, right.
Yes, we do all kinds of live virtual tastings, which, by the way, are also free and another wonderful way to learn about wine. You know, Sam, I want to say, too, that all of our videos, our live virtual tastings and videos, we did begin to do those during the height of the COVID pandemic, actually at the beginning of the COVID pandemic.
Right.
So remember, people were sheltering it in place, right? People were stuck at home. And I felt also that this would be a wonderful thing to do. You might not be able to go out and take a wine class, but you could join these live virtual tastings, again, for free, and kind of help you get through those, you know, all that solitude of the pandemic. And learn a little bit about wine at the same time. So
I think what's cool about that is a lot of people did that and disappeared. What's nice is you did it and you're still doing it.
Yes.
You know, and you're the right guy to do it. You know, it's like, thank God you're continuing in that sense. Because I think there's an appetite for that type of interaction and that type of information. I think you would agree. So how do we find that? Taste with Karen.
So all of the live virtual tastings that we do are, once you sign up for WineSpeed, you'll see every WineSpeed, there will be links in there to attend. We'll describe the next live virtual tasting we're going to do and when it is, and it gives you a link right there so that you can join very easily when the time comes.
So WineSpeed is a good portal to go to for all things Karen.
It is.
Okay. So then we gave people the information. I want to ask you a very general question, and we probably could do a whole show on it, but I want you to jog your brain, your mind, and just, you know, figure out a couple things. What's going on in the wine world that's caught your attention these days? You know, and this is, you know, you're a person, you know, you've done three editions of the wine library, you're pumping out content on a site. What's going on now that, you know, you think about, or you have to further research, or you have to travel? Is there anything, you know, that pops to the top of that list? Any few things?
Well, as a generalist, you know, a lot of people who write about wine are specialists because the world of wine is so big at this point. So I feel like I'm one of the last generalists, and hopefully I know as much about New Zealand as I know about Hungary, as I know about Oregon, as I know about California. So I'm all the time trying to keep current very broadly across the world. But one thing I think that anyone who loves wine has to be thinking about is climate chaos.
Yes.
And it's more than just climate change at this point.
Right.
It's really chaos in wine regions around the world. The other day I came across a statistic that said that wine grapes could be extinct in the next 28 years. This was from a very, very top-notch source. And I thought, oh my God, that is astounding. The major wine regions that we know right now, Bordeaux, Burgundy, Napa Valley, Tuscany, all of those major wine regions will be the ability to grow grapes will be reduced by 75% in the next 20 years.
That's so crazy.
Yes. And the wine industry is doing some things about that. We're using things like shade cloth and changing varieties in certain places, right, or planting hybrids, or looking at, different viticultural techniques. But my right. fear is that it could be too little too late.
That's the big argument. You know, you've drilled it down to, wine growing, wine making, the wine business. But I think the world is, in a similar boat. And like I said, I mean, we could do multiple shows on that. But I'm glad that that's the thing that's, looming, because I want everyone to be aware. And the word chaos, is right. I mean, it's thrown a lot of people in the wine business into chaos. With early frost, England becoming a sparkling wine mini Mecca, all these things going on. So, I would love to follow up. And there's discussion of that in the book. All right, Karen, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the book, and there's a lot to talk about, and I hope I can get to the important stuff. So we are talking to Karen McNeil. Karen just released her third edition of the Wine Bible. When we get back, we're going to get into that. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
I'm Jimmy Carboni, host of Beer Sessions Radio on HRN. I recently hosted a live podcasting event with local beer and spirits makers from beautiful Somerset County, New Jersey. We spoke on the farm that is home to Flounder Brewery and Belmar Distillery, one of the most beautiful stops along the Sip and See craft beverage trail.
To me, those two worlds, brewery and distillery, are extremely complementing businesses, especially in a unique location like this. So it immediately helped this become a destination to have a great experience, whether it's the beer atmosphere we've got going in here in the old barns, or the great experience you can have in there with these incredible cocktails that are created there. It's complementary to each other. You can have two completely different experiences all within a 10-foot walk from each other.
Before the event, I was able to tour the area and see the historic Bridge Tender's House along the serene DNR Canal, walk the bike and hiking trails, and take in the lush farmland. Then we settled into the centuries-old Dutch barn turned brewery for a lively discussion.
It was always important for us to create our space, our livelihood that we want to share with everybody else, of being a community-centric location. It is what makes us a brewery in this state different from a barn or restaurant. We're obviously family-friendly here. We have a lot of different groups that have their meetings here during the week. We just really want to become a community hub.
You can listen to this episode of Beer Sessions Radio, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again to Somerset County Tourism for supporting this episode. Learn more about the Sip and See Passport Program at visitsomersetnj.org. That's visitsomersetnj.org.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Karen McNeil. Karen, yesterday, and I'm happy to have her on the next day, released her third edition of the Wine Bible. Let's get the vitals out of the way. Whenever somebody writes a book, there's always a few things that I'm curious about, and I think people, are curious about. So at what point do you decide you needed to update the last edition and get out a third edition? Is it because I want to buy a new house and I need money, or a lot has happened since and I got to write about it?
Yeah, I don't think it's because I want to buy a new house and I need the money, because there's a lot of easier ways to make money than writing giant books like the Wine Bible.
Lay that out.
Yes. You know, Sam, it's a bit of a sense. You know, as a writer, you try and be a barometer of what's happening in the wine world. And so it's a sense that things have changed enough that you really need to redo what had been already a very big work. And knowing, by the way, that it's going to take years, not days and not months, but years to do. I suppose
you've been working on this for 4 years.
Yes.
So you started about 4 years ago and you sensed around then that it was time. But are things moving at a quicker pace now? I mean, the wine world is different than it was 10, 15 years ago, moving differently?
Yes, it's moving much faster, in part because technology is moving so fast.
Right.
So, you know, technology has, for example, opened up all of Asia to wine, not only just wine production, but, you know, your listeners will be probably familiar with WSET, Wine and Spirits Education Trust. And one out of every 1,000 people in Hong Kong have taken a WSET exam at this point. One out of every 1,500 people in Singapore have taken a WSET exam. So wine knowledge is just flying around the globe. And that has that's expanded the world of wine and the culture of wine.
That's only for the better.
Definitely.
So started 4 years ago, took you about 4 years. It took you, I think you said, 10 years to write the first book?
Exactly. I'm getting twice as fast. But the first book was written largely without the benefit of the internet. And people perhaps forget that before the internet, how did you do global research, right? You had to either go there, and I've been to most wine regions in the world, or you did your research by phone and by fax. You didn't just quickly look up how many wineries are there in Hungary by Googling it. There was no Google.
Isn't that crazy what you had to do then and what you can do now?
Yes. And it took, so everything that you were trying to learn to teach yourself and then ultimately to teach others took, sometimes many months of finding the right experts who you could talk to and interview. That has been just an enormous change.
But there's something to that when you can get right to the source, though, right?
Yes. Well, that's right. I mean, and it's also true that the internet has a lot of not very or accurate information or conflicting information.
Right.
So you still might have to get to the person who is, in fact, an expert on a given topic. But
right.
to find that person is a lot easier because you can at least use Google to find that person.
So one tool in a good way is you need to get to that person, but this helps you get to them. It's more important to find them than to get information about them. I kind of agree with that too. You know, you had mentioned climate change. When you first wrote the book, and what is that, 20 years ago? We're talking all in? When was the first book written?
2001.
Yeah. I mean, we're going into 2023, over 20 years. You talked about climate change, but do any other compelling changes or storylines come to mind since you set out to write that first book? That's a broad loaded question because you cover a lot of countries and the regions and things have happened. But again, does anything pop to the top of the list?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I mean, the world of wine is much, much bigger. So, you know, I had to kind of get my arms around a much bigger amount of information, types of wines, character of wines. And then in addition, in this new edition, I also went back to the past more in a chapter I call Ancient Wine, Wine at in the Very Beginning, which was a really fascinating chapter to research and write.
Right. So I guess the answer to that is, and not everything gets bigger, but the wine world got incredibly bigger, and the coverage of it, you know, required a lot more. So, I mean, that's fair. I mean, this book, it's larger size-wise. You know, it's, I think, your biggest book size-wise. It has more pages. What'd you say? It was about 800 pages?
Yes.
And it's now in color. Which you take for granted, but I mean, it makes the experience, you know, so much better, you know, when you, because wine's a very colorful thing in many ways. You follow a format in the book. I mean, there's a lot of information history, but you cover at least 23 winemaking countries and there are numerous, you know, regions within them. You have a format in each chapter. So let's talk to our listeners. And listen, here's an opportunity to delve into all these countries and their regions. You know, Italy has Tuscany, Piedmont, and, you know, so on and so forth. But when you get to each section, you basically make sure formatically, you know, that you cover a few things. Tell me how you design the chapters that way. I mean, you know, you do the history and quick sip. You always talk about grapes. Mm-hmm. You know, tell me what, you know, the information you're always going to get.
I think when you, there are two ways to write a book. One is, or two ways to write anything about wine. One is to say, here's what I know. Here's where I went. Too bad you weren't there, kind of.
Not good.
The other is, and the way that I write is to turn the binoculars around a little bit and think, what would someone want to know? What would be helpful to them to know? If that person were seated right here with me at in my office or at my kitchen table, what would be the logical things they'd want to know about Brunello di Montalcino, or about Rioja, or about the Barossa Valley, or about Marlborough, or any other wine region in the world? And so when you think about information that way, what do people want and what to know, need to know, and what would be fascinating for them to find out or to learn about, then you can begin to see the format of the book in your mind. But I guess too, early on, because I think this way, I just began doing lots and lots of sidebars, side boxes. It was a way of handling massive amounts of information and making them kind of like nuggets that you could easily absorb.
Otherwise, it gets too cumbersome and tedious,
yes,
right?
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, you're very succeeded at that visually and the way it's laid out and informationally.
Yeah, I think that kind of a format and that kind of learning approach has what has made the Wine Bible also like a favorite book among sommeliers, because sommeliers are, you know, they're often having to look things up very quickly or they're studying for an exam.
Right.
And the Wine Bible is laid out in a very easy to understand the information kind of way.
Right. I agree with that. It's very user-friendly. You know, there's a nerdiness to it, but it's very user-friendly. I mean, nerdiness as far as depth of information. But you pick it up and it's, like I said earlier, it's not hard to navigate. I mentioned you cover, you know, 23 countries. And you know, within some of them, like France and Italy, the US, I mean, there's a bunch of regions. In this edition, because of the changes in the 4 years and what you felt was important, you added a couple of countries and I guess a continent, South America. Tell me who is new in this book and why they went in.
Well, South America was in the second Wine Bible
We had like Chile and Argentina, but like I was invited to Uruguay a couple of years ago by the government. And when I got there, I just couldn't believe how evolved the wine program was there. So, I mean, you up that, you know, game. I mean, you made a chapter South America separate of Chile and all that.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And, you know, we're just starting to see old but new again wine regions like Croatia and Slovenia really come online. And those wines are often incredibly delicious. These were countries that were part of, in some cases, part of the former USSR, the Soviet Republic. But after the fall of communism, it took a good 20 to 30 years for these countries to begin to once again produce the phenomenal wines that they did when they were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the 1800s. So there's that, but there's also, as you mentioned, you know, whole new wine regions. I absolutely love English sparkling wine. So Great Britain has a chapter, which is absolutely brand new, because even in 2015, when the Second Wine Bible was published, sparkling wine made south of London was not something that any of us knew very much about.
Oh, for sure.
But now it's you know, it's an important part of the wine world. The chapters in Asia on China and Japan are much more expanded. Those two countries are rapidly becoming wine countries, especially China. So it's
worth paying attention to and expecting some interesting wines out of there.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Good to know. You added Israel. Why?
Yes. Israel, when I first started writing the Wine Bible, certainly Israel was already producing wine, but we didn't see an enormous amount of it in the United States. You know, come the Jewish holidays, which are around now.
Those are different wines than what they're growing there too now.
Yes. I mean, Israel has become a very sophisticated producer of Mediterranean varieties. And of course, it is the Mediterranean.
Right.
And Israel has a profound history of wine. Some of the earliest archaeological findings of the last decade have been in Israel. So it was definitely time to do Israel justice and to help people to see that Israel is not the same as, you know, Manischewitz or the kinds of, the kinds of grapey kosher wines that once dominated upstate New York.
Yeah. That's funny. My friend Yannick Benjamin was an ambassador for Israeli wines, and he was on the show, and we tasted through a lot of interesting stuff, and there's some compelling, you know, wines there. So that's definitely, you know, an interesting thing. I'm always curious, you know, you talked about Israel, Great Britain, you know, all the more recent entries into the South American market. Some of the oldest winemaking countries are now, you know, getting the recognition. When you look at the traditional winemaking regions, and let's start with maybe the top three, you know, which is France, Italy, and the U.S., is there anything new or noteworthy when you talk about them? You know, maybe I can answer the question first. Like in France, you know, the Loire, natural wines, whatever, and become big. But are those regions similar now to what they were doing then? Or, you know, there are things, I mean, you cover all of them in the book and you talk about that, but, you know, I want you to, you know, address that. So people just don't think, you know, 22 years later, France is doing the exact same thing. Tell me what you think.
Well, every wine region kind of advances its culture and its wine culture. And the great traditional regions of Europe, of course, do this. There are new techniques and new producers and the young sons and daughters of famous producers doing new and interesting things. And wine itself is changing as we understand more about the critical aspects of making it, and most importantly, the critical aspects of growing great grapes. So there's always something new and fascinating in every wine region. And I, you know, selfishly, I guess, I love to learn about those things. So when I approach a region like Spain or Portugal, which is very, on the one hand, very traditional, right, nonetheless, I can, in 2 or 3 days, fill a big notebook full of all kinds of new notes of things that are happening.
Yeah, Spain's a good example. There's a lot going on there region-wise. You know, what's old is new. You know, you even made that point with Eastern Europe and all of that. One of the things in Spain's doing it, France certainly was at the forefront, Italy. You talk a little about natural wine in the book. I want to get your take on, and I never know how to phrase it. I want to get your take on, you know, where you see natural wines or the natural wine movement today. You know, how do you define what natural?
Well, natural wine has no definition.
There's no box to put it in. So, you know, and has it become part of the mainstream or is it getting there? So instead of defining it, you know, how do you discuss what natural wine is?
Well, I should say that there is now a definition of natural wine in France, but in the U.S. and other countries, it's not defined. But it is understood that natural wine means wine to which next to nothing is done. Right. And I would say that, you know, that it has, in that, it has everything in common with great wines everywhere. Great wines are wines to which very little, as little as possible, is done, because the great wines of the world are those that reveal their place. And you can't through, you know, chemistry.
Right. They're farmed thoughtfully without all of those additions, as they say.
Yeah. Yeah. So, natural wine is a kind of philosophic statement about the drinker's belief that it is better to be hands off. And that, I think, is a philosophy that everyone can share.
You all right?
Oh, yes. I live, of course, we were talking about, I live in Napa Valley, and right in our little town of St. Helena, come the fall, what you might be hearing in the background noise are trucks full of grapes.
Yeah. Hey, listen.
That have been harvested.
That's fun, and it gives you a true taste. I'm just amazed my dog hasn't barked, you know, anytime during this interview.
So he's listening.
Yeah, he's actually sleeping. It's more me than you. Trust me that he's sleeping. So here's what perplexes me. So Karen, why wouldn't we be interested in anything but wines that, you know, are natural in the right way? You know, why would we want to drink wines that aren't farmed thoughtfully, you know, where there's not a lot of addition in the cellar? I mean,
because they're cheap. Commercial wines, wines that have a lot of stuff done to them, are cheap. The way those wines are made is to take substandard grapes, often grapes that have some kind of a problem, right, and through chemistry,
make them taste the same every year or whatever.
Yeah. And then,
yeah,
and
that's not what you advocate or write about, right?
No, definitely not.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's always going to be, you know, that segment. So it's not unfair that we should be cheerleaders, you know, for thoughtful farming and winemaking on a go forward basis. It's better for you, it's better for the earth type thing.
Absolutely.
Okay. Do you see, and again, you know, we're the box is kind of open, but what we talk about is wines that are natural. Are they more mainstream now, do you think? Do you see?
You know, I don't really know. New York has a very active natural wine.
Yes, like
community.
Paris was 20 years ago.
And yes, and so does France. Out here in Napa Valley, I think, you know, there's no wine bar that is a natural wine bar, but certainly the wine bars that are here celebrate, you know, real conscientious farming and a minimum of inputs into wine.
Right. I agree with that. It's funny. It's a fair point. I mean, I would say in New York in the last 5-7 years, the only things of note that have opened have been all these natural wine bars. My friend Jorge Riera at Frenchette, who had one of the first natural wine bars 5 years ago, they just opened up in Rockefeller Center, which is really prime New York Midtown, and he has an only natural wine list, which is sort of counter to who's, you know, around there, all the offices and, you know, retail. So I thought that's interesting. All right, a few things. I want to get to our wine list. I want you to answer those questions. But I want to ask you, I kind of want to end this segment of the interview with how you open your book. And you answer the question very deliberately, but I want you to be a little more general, emotional, or whatever. You ask, what makes wine great? So let's end the interview with that question. You don't have to tick off the 12 things, but just, what, Karen, what makes wine so great?
Well, there are those 12 principles.
Which you have to buy the book to know them.
To find
get
out, yes.
So yeah, that's a teaser, but I'm going beyond that.
Well, it is those things, though. I mean, that's what I look for when I'm
trying to cite a few of them.
Precision, distinctiveness, complexity, a sense of non-fruitedness, the ability to evoke an emotional response,
right,
balance, length. These are kind of overriding principles that are at work in the great wines everywhere in the world, not solely in one country or another.
Right.
And I think it's valuable to have both an understanding of your own subjective loves. But a lot of the wines that we all subjectively love are not necessarily great wines, right? They're just wines that we love for whatever reason. And that's fine. But there is, I believe, there are characteristics that truly great wines share. And yes, I think that's so important that I made it chapter one.
Well, I think you mentioned two things. I think you mentioned technical and emotional, you know, and ticking off some of those 12 things. So obviously, you know, making, farming, but also what it does to you. So I would encourage everyone for you to deeper understand what makes a great wine great. is, you know, go buy the book. But if you're one of those guys that just goes into the bookstore and reads it and leaves, okay, better than nothing, but just buy the book. All right. So, Karen, we always end the show with the wine list. We ask our guests five questions. We ask everyone the same five questions. We post them on social media. As I mentioned to you off air, our listeners love to hear what people like Karen McNeil are drinking, thinking, and doing with wine. So we're going to get into that. And like I said, I'm going to post it. Earlier in the show, I said you were on the 17th episode. I'm pretty sure you did a wine list. I'll try to do some comparisons. I don't remember, and I'm sure you don't. So here's the first question. The first question is, what are you drinking now? What is Karen McNeil drinking now? What's in your fridge? What's interesting you? You know, do you make a seasonal change? You know, you go from whites to reds. You know, what are you drinking now? Are you researching?
Well, it's not a like that, I think, for us here, because we are always writing about wine, we have to taste a lot of it, and I taste about 2,500 wines a year. Wow. And what's in my refrigerator is what from that we usually taste around 5 in the afternoon. And whatever were the best wines from that tasting are now what are in my refrigerators. And then I go home and cook dinner and have them with dinner.
Right. So the answer to that is driven by what you're always doing. You're tasting, yes. You're researching, and then you'll drill it down. So I think that's an answer in itself. But you kind of led me to the next question. The next question is, what's Karen's favorite wine and food pairing? Not something obviously eat every night, every week, every month, but what's that ooh-ah wine pairing? Not that you would recommend to people, but what you like.
I love champagne and a really creamy, creamy cheese.
Wow. I forgot to tell you this. I was afraid you were going to say champagne and oysters, which is not allowed on the show because it's too obvious. Now, let's talk about that. So champagne has acid, the bubbles, you know, one of the greatest, most underrated wines as far as what people think, not what we know. Why does it work well with the creamy cheese?
Because it's a bit like a yin-yang or a seesaw, you know, the creaminess and fat and salt in the cheese is so luxurious. And then you splice through that with the really racy acidity of the champagne. So your palate is on this little seesaw going back and forth.
I think that's great. Now, when you're talking about creamy cheeses, I mean, are you going beyond Brie? You know, what comes to mind when you said that?
Any triple creme French cheese.
That type of cheese. Yep. That seems like would fit the profile. All right. Great answer. Hopefully you'll answer this. And by answering it, you're not excluding anyone or favoring. You're just citing a few things. Do you have any favorite wine restaurants and or bars? You know, places that have a great list, great vibe when you walk in, knowledgeable people, you know, killer wine list. Is there anything local or in your travels that's just a fun place? And like I said, if you mention something, I'll disclaim this for you. If they see you, they go, Karen, I listened to that podcast. Why didn't you mention me?
Yes.
You know, it's because it wasn't, I'm just citing a few examples.
Yes. You know, I have to say that I'll be able to answer this question better later because of writing the book and also in part because of the pandemic. I have not been out and about in a lot of restaurants lately. And then some of my favorite smaller restaurants have, of course, sadly closed. So,
I'm going to come back to you on this.
Yes, please.
Because I post this stuff. I also have it on Instagram and on my sites where I have everybody's answers. You know, so you can go back to Raj Parr's answers from 2 years ago and see what he said. So I'm going to fill in the blanks. I'm going to stay with you on that. You just have to promise to remember and give me some answers. All right. Fourth question. The question is, and it probably was presented to you this way during the 17th show, what's your favorite all-time wine? Now, let me just disclaim this a little. When I asked that question, I was very curious about, hey, what's the rarest, most expensive wine Karen, you know, drank, and tell me about it. I'm less interested in that answer, and I'm more interested in the wine that became important to you, that was a gateway, that changed the way you thought about it, you know, that impressed you, that's important to you. Is there a wine or two that just stands out, you know, in your wine life that did or meant something?
Well, all kinds of wines, of course.
It may be too many for
that
you.
Role. You know, lately I have been tasting a lot of Willamette Valley Pinot Noir from Oregon.
And
I'm very impressed by those wines. They're just so sublime. And Pinot Noir is, you know, it's, I don't know, it's the sexiest of all wines for sure.
I agree. You know, that's what Burgundy is. Burgundy is sexy. So, you know, that's our, we're doing it here. That's a good one. I'll stay with that. So right now, that's, you know, what's important. All right, last question, and you should be able to answer this. I ask everyone to recommend to me best wine retail around $15, $20, $22. I want you to recommend a red. I want you to recommend a white. You could recommend a region. Like, I think Muscadet is a great value for a white. Zinfandel, you know, can be had as a red. Give me in that price range, because my kids are in their late 20s and they can't afford $50, $60 bottles, but they don't want to buy or give that supermarket wine that we were talking about. So how do you wow for $15, $20, $22?
Yeah, we have, there's a section in Wine Speed called Steals.
Ah.
And those are all, every week, those are wines that are under $25. And they're from all over the world, all styles of wine. So, and if you go on the Wine Speed website, you can look at every last steal we've ever written about. And
okay, so
it's very quick and easy, and you'll find hundreds of them there.
So how long has Wine Speed been around?
Since 2016.
What month? Because I'm trying to figure if you stole my idea. No, I'm joking.
I don't think
it's
so.
Same thing. The whole idea of this is to hear from you, and I will point people towards Wine Speed. How to get, you know, great value at that price range. Because
Right. Even
if you step up to $20, $22, you could still get a crappy wine.
Sure.
So that's important. All right. So that's a good answer. All right. So Karen, like I said, I am going to post all these answers so everyone you know, could pursue some of these wines. All right. Let me do a quick wrap up because I know I got to let you go, and I want to get some info from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Leave a review if you like the podcast. You can follow us on Instagram at sbenruby and on Twitter at benruby. I know that can be confusing, but you can always get to us via the hashtag TheGrapeNation to find us on both. We're on Facebook at The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, we will post Karen's wine list so that you could take a deeper look at that. So Karen, let's talk about the book first. If we want to order the book, tell me the best ways you think we should order it.
Yes. Well, the Wine Bible is for sale, of course, in all bookstores and on Amazon. But if you want it signed and personalized, I can, you know, and a lot of us want a personalized book for giving holiday gifts. you can get the Wine Bible very easily by going again to either KarenMcNeil.com or winespeed.com. There's a little Wine Bible tab, and it will you'll be able to order the book right there and tell me who you'd like it personalized to.
So you can just order the book there if you want, among other booksellers, and you can order a personalized copy.
Yes.
So that's a great option. All right. WineSpeed, winespeed.com.
Yes, exactly.
That's where we're going to go to get the answer to the fifth question, which is wines around 15, 20, 22 bucks, right? So go to wine. We didn't talk about it, but you put your hand in designing stemware. Tell me quickly about that.
Yes, these they're called the Flavor First Collection, and it's doing extremely well. We just launched them about a year ago, and they're glasses that revolve entirely around flavor. If you again take a look at the Flavor First Collection, you'll see. So, Sam, it has been really great talking with you thus far.
All right, I'm going to let you go. I want to thank our guest, Karen McNeil. Look out for Karen's book, the third edition of the Wine Bible. Thank you to our engineer, Kevin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.